everyone, and welcome to the first ever episode of AT Podcast, a series where we explore and understand how research works in the environment and ecology, and how its implementation can pull us out of climate doom. The AT Podcast is your one-stop shop of curated content on conservation, sustainability, and the environment. This is Namrata Murli.
And this is Shri Priya Sridharan. In this episode, we would like to take you on a journey through ATRI, what we do, who we are, and what our evolution has been. We have the pleasure of being in conversation with Dr. Kamaljeet Bawa today. We may need an episode in its entirety to list his many, many accomplishments and accolades. However, to name a few, Dr. Bawa has been a distinguished professor of biology at the University of Occident of Ashoka Trust for Research in Ecology and Environment, popularly known as ATRI, that he founded in the year 1996.
An evolutionary biologist by training, he now works in sustainability science. He is the recipient of the Gunners Prize in Sustainability Science, the International Midori Prize in Biodiversity, the Linnean Medal, and honorary doctorates from the University of Alberta and Concordia University in Montreal. He's an elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Philosophical Society, and the Royal Society. So let's get started.
Hello, Dr. Bawa. Welcome to ATRI Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. It's good morning here. I would say good morning, but I think it's evening in Delhi or Bangalore. Good evening.
Yes, good evening and good morning to you. So, Dr. Bawa, for the millennials and Gen Z and all the conscious youth out there, ATRI would be a dream organization to join hands with. And considering your phenomenal work in ecology, biodiversity, and livelihood, we are curious to know, how did ATRI come into being? Like, what were those challenges that made your blood boil to bring about some change?
First of all, let me say you are very kind and generous. And I think it was in 1990s that I had resumed my work in India. And within 2 or 3 years, I had a very active research program on biodiversity in the Western Ghats, in collaboration with Professor Umashankar and Professor Ganesha. Our program was rapidly expanding. And within a couple of years, Dr. Sharad Lele, Dr. K.S. Murli, and Dr. Balachandra Ganesan had joined the group. And we were moving so fast, and I thought we would be working on these issues for decades to come. So I felt the need to institutionalize this very dynamic, very rapidly expanding program. At that time, in mid-1990s, there was no institute in India that was devoted to the study of biodiversity as a whole. And at different levels, from genes to ecosystems, institutes that can link science with policy, science with society, almost all institutions in India at that time were approaching biodiversity on a sectoral basis. Forestry, wildlife, fisheries, plants or animals. Second, there was no organization that was addressing multiple dimensions of biodiversity loss. That is, ecological, social, economic, and political aspects of biodiversity decline and how to stem this decline. Third, almost all institutions were largely in the public sector, and their approach to address the problems was purely biological or based in natural sciences, whereas the study of biodiversity and its loss required more nuanced approaches rooted in sociology, anthropology, economics, governance, and policy. So these were the considerations that shaped our early ideas about ATRI and the initial issues ATRI will address.
That's interesting. Thank you for sharing that story.
So, Dr. Bawa, how would you say ATRI has evolved over the years to encompass the broader issues of the environment? You pioneered interdisciplinary research in India 25 years ago. What is the benefit of this rather than working in silos? And why is there not many institutions even today in India and the world over not doing interdisciplinary research?
It is true that E3, our initial focus was biodiversity, but we soon took up water, because water is perhaps the most important ecosystem service provided by nature. The next logical issue was climate change, for a couple of reasons. First, climate change is the most serious environmental challenge we face today. Second, climate change is deeply intertwined with the issue of biodiversity. For example, natural ecosystems take up carbon from the atmosphere, and their destruction leads to releases of carbon back into the atmosphere. Third, nature-based solutions such as restoration of degraded lands, soils, forests, and other natural ecosystems offer the least expensive ways to mitigate climate change. By nature-based solutions, I mean biodiversity-based solutions. Thus, for a number of reasons, I think it made a lot of sense for us to devote our attention to climate change. Now, with respect to interdisciplinary work, but before I talk about interdisciplinary work, let me emphasize the fact that I think A3 is one of the very few institutions that is addressing these issues of biodiversity, water, and climate change at the same time. And of course, more recently, we have added to the portfolio a number of other issues too, and we will talk about that later. But now, with respect to interdisciplinary work, again, in my mind, it is the most effective way to address complex problems. And these problems are complex, as I mentioned earlier. Furthermore, in sustainability science, interdisciplinary work is often applied research designed to generate knowledge that can immediately address societal challenges. It is difficult to practice interdisciplinary research in established institutions, and that's why we don't see many institutions engaging in such work, because such institutions that are old and established, tradition and silos are the basis of their structure. Thus, for example, these established institutions have departments of economics, sociology, history, anthropology, biology, and so on. And there is little incentive for collaboration. And collaboration is hard. It is hard to work as a team, especially in academia, because everybody has their own ideas. And thus, interdisciplinary work is difficult. Progress is slow because there are many moving parts that must be aligned. Team members must respect each other and be mutually supportive. Now, things are changing. New institutions are coming up in India, such as Azim Premji University, Ashoka University, Kriya University. They are structured very differently. Thus, I am very hopeful that in future we will see more such centers.
Dr. Bhavat, speaking of how things were done traditionally, usually research institutions function as an ivory tower. Why was it important to you that ITRI wasn't one such institution that functioned as an ivory tower?
Well, first of all, let me say it was important not only to me, but also to others at ITRI. ITRI was established to resolve pressing environmental problems for the benefit of society. I think everybody realizes at ITRI that the ivory tower-based approach will not allow us to realize our goals. So as we generate knowledge, we have to ask how we address the various dimensions of the problem, as I indicated earlier, how we involve other stakeholders in generating knowledge, how we will apply that knowledge to offer more options, policymakers, and how we change action on the ground, the way people use resources, the way they conserve resources. And I want to tell you here, you know, one of the transforming experiences I ever had was in Biligiri Rangan Hills, when I started the work there in early 90s. We had started a very complex project on the extraction of non-timber forest products by the Soligas, the indigenous group of people that live in Biligiri Rangan Hills. We were looking at the impact of extraction of such products as amla, lichens, and honey produced by wild bees on the ecology of the forest and the ways to sustain these extractions, so that the Soligas, as well as their ecosystems, benefit from our interventions. Initially, we thought we had all the right questions. But at some point, it occurred to me that we should talk to Soligas and see how appropriate and how valid our questions were. Thus, over a week, I organized a series of meetings, many, many villages, and we talked, asking Soligas the questions they had in mind. And the answers we got reinforced some of the questions, but also led us to ask different questions and to work with Soligas more closely than we had anticipated. And I want to emphasize, this was much before we started talking about co-production of knowledge and co-creation that are the themes now, major themes in sustainability science. So those experiences really transformed at least my thinking for years to come. And certainly it had impact innately in terms of how we formulate projects and how we proceed with our work.
I love the way you shared the story of your work with the Soliga community. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners too will have experienced a similar way, that just they have knowledge around a certain subject, but then when they are going to implement those projects, many a times we miss out on asking the direct impactors how is it going to transform their lives. So on that point, I want to ask you, asking questions, like, what significance does it hold in your life, and how has the act of asking questions evolved within you over time?
Well, if there are no questions, then there cannot be any answers. Sadly, when I was attending schools and colleges in 50s and 60s, we were not taught to think creatively and to ask questions. In fact, the norm at that time was not to question your parents and teachers. So I vividly remember in 1967, when I went to the United States immediately after submitting my doctoral thesis. And I think within days of my arrival there, I read a paper by Dan Jansen, a very famous tropical biologist, just come out. And the paper was entitled, Why Mountain Passes Are Higher in the Tropics. And then there was another paper, What is a Dandelion? What is aphid? I think these papers demonstrated to me the ways to ask complex questions to retain your focus and formulate your hypothesis. I also remember in 1975, I was at Oxford and Gordon Frankie, a tropical biologist, presented a paper. And the title of that paper was, Why Do Bees Move Among Widely Spaced Trees in a Tropical Forest? I was sitting next to my old classmate from Punjab University days, and he turned to me and said, Why do Americans constantly ask questions? I responded, That is how they bring innovation and research and advanced knowledge. I told him that our educational system really had failed us for not making us learn to think and ask questions. So I think asking constant questions, that's how you advance knowledge, how you make advances in science.
I am sure that now with the evolution of internet around us, that gap between different countries in terms of asking questions has definitely become shorter. And that's why today climate change and sustainability have become a big rage. It's become the new trend. It's become a buzzword. And the growing number of climate protests across the globe have actually the temperature and the anger within the youth today. I am really curious to know, how was the youth movement like when you started your journey almost 50 years back? It was, I'm sure at that time, sustainability across the globe were just on near its baby steps.
I think I must say, in relation to the comments I just made, of course, things have changed now considerably in India. And I don't think we have that tradition of not questioning what is happening in our society or questioning elders that strong. And I think there have been remarkable changes, all very positive in our educational system. But I was talking mostly about that time, when I was growing. And at that time, basically, people were not encouraged to question anything. As you know, there was a strong tradition to follow the elders and mentors. But when I went to the U.S. in 1967, I went there at the height of the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement led by young people on the university campuses. And more importantly, for our discussion, the modern environmental movement started at that time too. It coincided with the movement to oppose war. And this was the movement against air and water pollution. And the start of the movement was inspired, as many of you know, by the publication of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, which was published in 1962. And although Carson passed away in 1964, others have come in to join the movement. And the towering figure by the time I arrived in the U.S. in 1967 was Barry Commoner. Some of you might remember that. Barry Commoner was a cell biologist, but in terms of activism and in terms of advocacy, he was a leading spokesman for ecology and environmental issues at that time. His book, Closing Circle, was published in 1971, and the book advocated changes in the U.S. economy for the resolution of environmental problems. So you see, we have, in a way, the beginning of interdisciplinarity to resolve our major environmental challenges. So anyway, at that time, it was a most unusual experience, at least for me, to see young people on the university campuses challenge the establishment, you know, the economic establishment, the political establishment, the academic establishment for the betterment of the environment. And as I said earlier, one could see the beginnings of connections among ecology, economy, and politics, and the ability of people, especially young people, to be the agents of change. And one can see, you know, I certainly can see more activism among young people in India. I'm sitting in front of two young, dedicated people. and I think things are changing in India. And I'm sure we will see a sort of a quantum jump in the years to come, in the next few years. And that's a very, very hopeful sign.
Dr. Bava, as you said, things are changing for the better in most things, but youth today are more disconnected, and working towards the environment can take a toll on young folks' emotions, right? So what would you advise youngsters today who are beginning their careers in environmentalism? How would you advise them to take care of their own mental health when they're surrounded by all of this negativity?
Well, I have never been discouraged by the gloomy news about the environment. There are many things that affect my mental well-being, and the least of which is the gloom and doom about the environment. There's no question we are facing huge challenges. But I remain very optimistic that we will address these challenges. And I'm also convinced that it is the young people in the coming generation that will take us over the hill. So my advice to young people is this. My generation, despite the limited knowledge and toolkits it had, was able to advance our discipline and solve problems. We founded the discipline of conservation biology or biodiversity science. We went a step further and established sustainability science. We resolved many environmental problems. Pollution in many parts of the world, sadly not in India yet, ozone layer. Saved species from extinction. As compared to my generation, the new generation can combine concepts and disciplines in a way that my generation could not conceive. The new generation can link knowledge with policy and action on the ground in a manner I could not think of 50 years ago. The new generation has ideas and tools that I could not even imagine when I started my career. So you see why I'm optimistic? I'm very optimistic about future.
That's a great food for thought. And your advice actually made me think once again, like, okay, why are we even creating a fuss about it? We are more equipped than any generation on our planet thus far. And I think we all have the power to utilize it as an arsenal and create that transformation. Thank you, Dr. Bava, for sharing that thought with us. I also wanted to ask you, could you shed some light on the National Biodiversity Mission and what it means to any citizen of our country?
Of course, one of the important goals of the Biodiversity Mission is to advance biodiversity science in all its multiple dimensions. But the mission places biodiversity at the heart of economic development planning in India. Working with development agencies in India, the national mission will apply nature-based solutions to declining biodiversity and ecosystem services, to complex agricultural production systems, widespread soil and land degradation, emerging infectious diseases, climate change mitigation, disaster risk mitigation, and the mission will generate green employment opportunities. The mission will also build human resources, foster evidence-based policies and decentralized governance, and mainstream biodiversity into national public consciousness. Mission success will be measured by India's progress towards the UN Sustainable Development Goals, promoting environmental health and human well-being, and largely through environmental protection and restoration. Thus, the outcome of the mission will affect every citizen. So it is basically, one can say, oriented not only towards science, but I think towards the well-being of everybody in India.
Thank you, Dr. Bawa, for sharing that with us.
Dr. Bawa, you mentioned that the mission will help mainstream biodiversity consciousness amongst every Indian. What importance would it bring to every average citizen? What can an average citizen do to contribute to this cause?
As I say, often biodiversity is everywhere. It affects all aspects of our lives. We all have a lot to contribute to conservation of biodiversity, so that it continues to enrich our lives and sustain us. The mission will have a very strong program on biodiversity informatics and citizen science, so that we can engage public in various activities. For example, citizens will be able to make contributions in exploring and discovering biodiversity, in describing biodiversity, educating their children in sustainable use of biodiversity, educating them about the cultural and spiritual relevance of biodiversity to our lives. Citizens can contribute to conservation by engaging their civic and political leaders in conservation efforts. So there are a number of ways I think citizens will be able to contribute. We indeed have to provide knowledge, means, and tools to enable wider participation. I think since we started with interdisciplinarity, let me close by saying that the ultimate test of interdisciplinarity is the extent to which we can bring scientists, including social scientists, public and private sector, and citizens together to meet our most pressing environmental challenges. So I see tremendous change in India, and I remain very hopeful.
Thank you, Dr. Bawa, for joining us for this incredible conversation, with this incredible insight into ATRI, into the field of conservation, biodiversity, sustainability studies, all of that over the past 25 years and more.
Through this podcast, we are able to encourage more citizens to take action. And I am sure your episode is going to be a trigger to drive that change.
Hey there, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you liked it, please hit subscribe. If you feel this was enlightening, please share with your friends and family.
You can follow our work across social media platforms. Just type ATRI or Ashoka Trust for research in ecology and environment, and you'll find us there. Thank you so much for tuning in. See you soon in the next episode. I'm Shri Priya Sridharan.
And this is Namrata Murli.
Signing off.
Thank you.